What the Ducklings Did on Their Summer Vacation, a House SGA crossover, rated PG-13, Gen, written by Roger, read by Anna Sinner. 2 weeks after he was fired, Chase had finished watching all 3 seasons of Grey's Anatomy and 6 seasons of Scrubs. Well, the episodes were shorter. Reorganized his entire kitchen, returned his kitchen back to the way it was, alphabetized his porn collection by cover girl last name, and invented a new drink called the Lupa Lupi, non-alcoholic, tastes like litchi. He had also sent his CV to 20 hospitals in 10 states, gone on 3 job interviews, had confidence-building sex with Cameron before each of her 3 interviews, and had coffee with Foreman once. They'd wanted to talk about the New York job application and instead ended up talking about grades. At the moment, he was sitting at a corner table of a small coffee place below his apartment, discreetly staking out the building mailbox, waiting for various prospects to get back to him, and bored out of his mind. The lettuce leaves in his salad bowl were starting to look interesting compared to his life. Chase dejectedly poured some balsamic vinegar over the lettuce, the back of his mind's attention on the still empty mailboxes, the rest concentrating deeply on whether one could apply tea leaf fortune-telling to his salad ingredients. "Your future is green, wrinkly, and slightly nibbled on," they seemed to say. "Beware of strangers attempting to lure participants into the project. I mean, bloody hell, I've only got 2 days of leave. I'm jet-lagged out of me frickin' skull. And all I want to do is visit home and get a taste of Mum's haggis before I get back to Antarctica and then Colorado. Not go on a quest for the holy genetic grail in bloody New Jersey." The hissed diatribe was coming from a table behind him, and Chase struggled not to turn around and stare. "Antarctica?" "I know it was the only flight getting out of the outpost," the voice continued, testily. I know, Shepard, I know this is a great American university, and it's a great opportunity to hire some extra people for my staff, but it's not exactly simple finding genetically compatible Oh, shit, I gotta go, somebody's choking." Chase jumped at the stranger's words, looked around the room, and scrambled to the side of the old woman 3 tables down, who was wheezing and flailing her arms at her hysterical son, a small pile of chicken wing bones on her plate. Chase quickly locked his arms under the woman's diaphragm to perform a Heimlich maneuver, and was on the verge of thrusting when someone collided into him from behind, causing the piece of expelled chicken to sail across the open air and land in another diner's water glass with a plop, befitting the cheap romantic comedy Chase's life had apparently turned into. The man who had collided into Chase immediately knelt beside the old woman, who was taking in huge gasps of air. "There now," he soothed, Scottish accent rolling off his tongue. "Breathe easy. It's okay. You're okay now." Chase took a step back and let the other man deal with his still panicking family, his eyes already wandering over to where the mail truck had just parked across the street, no doubt holding in its red and white recesses the ticket to Chase's future. And then the man was standing in front of Chase, one hand extended, tired eyes crinkling at the corners. "Dr. Carson Beckett," he introduced himself. "That was a good job, lad." Chase clasped his hand distractedly and said, "Robert Chase, and it was really no—" "Holy mother of God, what the hell is that?" As the pendant of a necklace hanging around Beckett's neck spontaneously lit up and started floating in midair. Beckett glanced down in surprise. "Well," he said, all reverberating in his voice, "that was much easier than I'd expected." While Chase and Cameron joined the Atlantis expedition because they could both make things light up and sparkle, and were, when it came down to it, attracted to shiny things, Foreman's thought process had been of a more mathematical nature, reasoning that "I'm unemployed, plus advanced imaging technology, plus great alien dental plan, plus House would kill for this opportunity, plus can't get much farther from House than this," equaled totally taking the job. It took them less than 48 hours to be issued security clearances, thoroughly debriefed, and prepared for their missions, which was remarkably efficient for any organization controlled by the government. "It's a bloody international project, you condescending jerks," Chase kept reminding them. He had a tiny British flag patch stitched to his jacket, which he insisted was Australian because of the few white stars scattered around it. They left Earth on the Daedalus astonishingly enough, by actually getting beamed up into the spaceship. "Wow," Cameron whispered, watching clouds swirl over Earth's ocean from the ship's bridge, thousands of miles away. "It's breathtaking." "Yes," Chase said softly. Cameron sneaked a peek at him, watching the view, entranced, and then smacked him on the arm. "How?" he yelled. "What was that for?"
"You were supposed to be looking at me when you said that, not the view."
"Sorry," he said defensively. "I guess I'm not fluent in celestial etiquette."
"That wasn't celestial etiquette. It was just a little romance."
Foreman rubbed his temples. "If you both don't shut up, I'm letting you off at the next stop." "There, there, duckies," Dr. Beckett said with an amused smile. "Play nice. We're going to be together for a long time now."
"Don't worry," Cameron said. "We're used to each other's presence."
As it turned out, however, they hadn't been. Long night shifts of running tests and babysitting patients, and the occasional sleepover, in Chase and Cameron's case, had created only the bare minimum of familiarity between them. And over the course of the 3-week journey to Atlantis, the small confining space of the Daedalus provided a far more comfortable means of getting to know one another. For the first time in almost 3 years of mutual acquaintance, they talked honestly about home and family, about scars and pets and peculiarities, to the relaxing aroma of late-night coffee and the glow of soft, shimmering blue hyperspace light. It was only when Cameron was getting into the details of how Mother Nature let her know she was a woman at 13 that Foreman finally cried, "You know I care about you, but for the love of God, TMI!" Cameron was so pleased about the first half of his sentence that she let the subject drop. In addition to Dr. Beckett, returning to Atlantis from a short leave on Earth, where Lieutenant Colonel John Shepherd, a messy-haired officer who seemed to live in a constant state of leisurely amused, and Dr. Rodney McKay, who was, well,
"He's like Robin Williams with a giant brain on speed," Chase said, wide-eyed.
They were on a tour of the warship, and McKay was standing irritably on the other side of one of the hangar bays, ranting at Shepherd.
"He's like some sort of evil Einstein," Cameron stared, "totally out of control. Soon he'll be tearing his hair out, and let's face it, it's not like there's much to begin with."
Shepherd was beginning to grin, which seemed to enrage McKay all the more, gesturing wildly as he yelled out about "blithering idiots" and "IQ of a Teletubby" and "stop smirking, you juvenile moron."
"Look at that," Foreman said with a small sneer. "He's acting like a total jackass. It's disgusting what people can get away with, just because they've convinced the world they're irreplaceable."
"Well, I can't imagine people like him too much around here," Cameron said.
"Price of being a genius," Chase said sagely. "They're all royally fucked up."
McKay was growing more and more furious. Shepherd was obviously biting his lip to keep from laughing.
"Just look at House," Chase added.
"Guys?" The three of them jumped at the sound of the lazy drawl addressing them. Shepherd was looking straight at them from across the hangar bay, the corners of his lips twitching.
"You know we can hear you, right?"
Foreman raised a hand to his earpiece, flicking it off.
"Damn," he muttered. "I keep forgetting about those."
Cameron let out a mortified squeak. Shepherd just flashed them a thumbs up and steered a sputtering McKay out of the room.
"Awkward," Chase hummed.
Shortly after their arrival at Atlantis, it became clear to everyone that Cameron would be wasted in the infirmary, seeing as every time she so much as walked by a federal jumper, it practically began to purr.
"Come on," Lieutenant Colonel Shepherd told her, dragging her into one of the aircraft as Chase watched with a frown. "We're going for a ride."
When they returned an hour later, Shepherd's expression was an even mixture of smug and impressed, and Cameron had stars in her eyes.
"I'll be taking over this one," he told Beckett, and that appeared to settle that.
"I don't know what she sees in him," Chase later told Foreman over breakfast, adding sugar to a tasteless sort of porridge. Foreman smirked.
"Him?"
"It," Chase scowled. "I said it. Flying. It's not like she's saving lives or anything. She's just a glorified taxi driver."
"And you're a glorified magic wand."
Chase looked affronted.
"I am not. I did clinic duty yesterday. It's not my fault McKay needed me to explore B3's lower levels with him later."
"And you followed him around like a good little puppy,"
Foreman said, shaking his head. Nothing ever changes with you, does it?
You don't know what you're talking about, Chase dismissed, speaking around a mouthful of toast. As it happens, my job here is essential.
His words were cut short by a blaring alarm and harsh flashing lights that certainly couldn't have been signaling he would live a long and healthy life.
Chase swallowed. That can't be good.
10 minutes later, Chase was relegated to chair duty, and Foreman was fully suited, handed a gun and a medical kit, and on his way to PD-8-512, which he was assured was inhabited by very peaceful human-like things, except for when insulted by the accidental implication that you'd like to grill the holy goat. It was all, Beckett promised him, par for the course. The days passed, and slowly but surely they settled into their new life, alternating between the infirmary and labs and the sky and off-world missions. The Stargate on PG-9004 was located on the smallest of a group of islands, surrounded by a great purple ocean, shimmering in the orange sunset. It was very picturesque, up until the moment Chase and Foreman found themselves held captive in a cell with a frustrated Ronan Dex, an aggravated Zelenka, a slowly panicking McKay, and a counter ticking down to zero.
So, you're saying it's a nuclear bomb? Chase asked, trying to keep the alarm from showing in his voice.
Yes, Ronan snarled, banging a fist in the wall. Chase exchanged a look with Foreman. Foreman shrugged and settled himself in a comfortable position on the stone floor.
Well, nice to see you relaxing for a change, Chase said sourly.
Foreman closed his eyes, looking serene. Do you know how to dismantle a nuclear bomb?
Well, no, Chase admitted, but I like to think outside the box. Surely we can help somehow.
Ronan indicated McKay and Zelenka with a tilt of his head and raised his eyebrows, as if saying, when they get like this, it's not even worth trying. Chase threw his hands in the air.
How did we even get in this situation? I mean, I've had people mad at me before. I worked for House, after all. But nobody's ever wanted to actually vaporize my particles. How can you just take it sitting down?
Foreman folded his arms behind his head, looking for all the world like he was sprawled on a beach chair in the Caribbean. If I try to help, McKay's going to make one of his arrogant house-like cracks, and the next time he does that, I'm going to snap and kill him with my bare hands. As a doctor who spent time on the streets, I can actually do that. So, he finished in a perfectly calm voice, for the sake of our survival and my blood pressure, I think I'm going to sit this one out.
Chase took a moment to let it sink in.
You have a point.
Hey, Peanut Gallery, McKay snapped, tinkering with the panel of crystals. Can we cut the background chatter? It's like trying to work at a ladies' bingo night here. Oh, and by the way, I have ears, a fact you two can't seem to stop forgetting.
Hush, Rodney, Zelenka said sternly. You're scaring the ducks. McKay broke away from his little nuclear toys to gape at Zelenka.
What ducks?
This is what Dr. Beckett calls them.
Oh, for... And comprehension dawned. He's Scottish. Everyone's either a duck or a peach to him.
Rodney, less time on complaining, more time on taking apart bomb, hmm?
McKay's eyes narrowed. I don't need you, of all people, to tell me to concentrate on the task at hand, he muttered, while returning to his work with gusto. You think I'm not perfectly aware of the fact that the seconds of my life are ticking down along with this clock, and that the fate of everyone in this room hangs upon my intellect? You're so lucky I'm trapped in here, too, by the way. Otherwise, I'm not sure I'd even be bothered. Aha!
There was a beep. The timer froze at 0:19:23. McKay stepped back, surveying the visibly dying down device with a self-satisfied smirk.
Once again, my superior intellect has saved the day. Why do these things always beep? For once, I wish there was something more appropriate. A hallelujah chorus singing, Hooray, McKay, would be nice. You know, in Russia, whenever I saved the world, which was twice, my employees baked me a cake. How come you never do that?
Not your employee, McKay, Zelenka reminded him, and rolled his eyes. The ducks are right. You're just like my house, big and white and full of too much crap.
Ronan snorted, settling down next to Foreman and adopting his laid-back position.
Rodney scowled.
What do you mean, big? He muttered, and then froze, as if something in his head had just clicked into place. Wait a minute! He stared at Chase and Foreman. This house you keep talking about, you don't by any chance mean Gregory House?
Chase looked at him in surprise. Actually, we do. Oh my God, McKay groaned. I hate that kid.
Chase blinked at the suggestion of House having ever been anything other than a 40-year-old asshole, at the very least.
You know House? He asked, dubiously.
No, despise, same difference, McKay said, waving a hand.
No wonder you people are so irritating. You must have learned it from him.
Foreman was still sprawled lazily on the ground, and though his eyes were closed, his brows lifted with amusement, as though he wasn't surprised at all at this turn of events.
And when did you two meet?
Gregory House, McKay huffed, was a scrawny little kid, well, bigger than me, obviously, but I'd skipped a few grades, who cheated his way into the finals of the 30th Annual International American Spelling Bee during that single loathsome year my parents moved us to D.C. And yes, there is such a thing, and no, it's not an oxymoron. Oh, and yes, he definitely cheated, that rat bastard, entering the contest with an unfair advantage of having lived in a gazillion different countries before the age of 10, and not disclosing the fact that he knew Arabic, which is similar enough to Turkish, that he should have been disqualified from the Middle Eastern round anyway. And besides, everyone knows Czechoslovakia lila sira ma declare mes denis misses can be spelled with 3 S's instead of 4, so really, I should have won.
Foreman's eyelids rose lazily.
What?
Czechoslovakia lila sira ma declare mes denis misses, McKay repeated with scorn. It's in Turkish. It means, apparently you were amongst the one that we couldn't make a Czechoslovakia citizen.
Hey, Zelenka said.
Yeah, Chase added, pretty sure he should be offended.
Hey!
Zelenka turned to Chase, looking as if he were seeing him for the first time.
Just check?
He asked, stunned.
Ne,
Chase replied, struggling to recall the language.
Mush otek, mluvim shesky, jenom troshe.
No, no, Zelenka cried, reverting back to English. You speak very good Czech. Your father would be proud.
I've never really embraced the heritage from that side of the family, Chase said, slightly apologetic, mostly hoping to steer away from the topic of his father. But I did follow them in the Eurovision this year, he offered.
Zelenka's eyes widened. No, we were in Eurovision for the first time and I didn't see. How did we do? How many deuce points? He asked eagerly.
Well, one.
Ah, not too bad, not too bad.
No, I mean 1 point, Chase clarified. From Estonia.
Zelenka's face fell. All of Europe are anti-ex-communist pigs, he said darkly.
Yes, 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 said McKay. Everyone's conspiring against you. Somehow I don't find it that surprising. If I may suggest, for the sake of my peace of mind, how about everybody just shut up until Colonel Shepherd deigns to wake up from his afternoon nap and rescues us in a ridiculously timely fashion, hm?
Seconded, Ronan grunted, raising a hand.
The next 2 hours were spent, therefore, in relatively comfortable silence, broken only once by McKay, who pointedly looked at his watch and muttered, "It's a good thing I dismantled that bomb, otherwise we'd all be dead in right about 4, 3, 2 now." Finally, their radios sparked to life. "Jumper 2, this is Jumper 3, do you read?"
Chase's eyebrows spiked to his hairline.
"Cameron?"
"It's good to hear your voice, Doctor,"
Cameron's warm voice replied. "Can you give me a head count down there?"
"Jumper 3, this is McKay," McKay snapped. "I'm here with Zelenka, Ronan, and the Too Many Becketts. It's about damn time you got here. What's your ATA?"
Another voice crackled through the radio.
"Rodney?"
McKay frowned.
"Shepard?"
"Are you guys okay?" Shepard asked.
"Well, thanks to me, we're alive," McKay replied, glaring at the ceiling as if Shepard were somewhere beyond it. "Okay is a direct derivative of how long I have to stay on this rock, so if you will please hurry up."
"Can't, sorry," said Shepard. "I'm with Taylor on Jumper 1. We're on our way to deal with the locals. Gonna try and get back that little puddle jumper your team managed to lose. But don't worry, you're in good hands with Shaft. Shepard out."
"Oh, wait, it was my fault now? Shepard!"
McKay cut himself off when they heard the static. Jumper 1 was out of range.
"Sometimes I really hate that guy."
Ronan got to his feet and slapped him on the back.
"You hate a lot of guys, McKay.
Hate me too?" McKay got as far as, "Believe me, sometimes," before realizing who it was he was talking to,
and how very tall he loomed. McKay gulped.
Of course I don't.
Jumper 2, Cameron said calmly in their earpieces. Major Lorne is hooking 2 bricks of C4 to the northern wall of your cell, so you may want to step back and cover your head. Ready when you are.
Ronan herded them all to the southern side of the room and crouched low, waiting for them to follow.
That thing gonna blow up? He pointed at the nuke.
Of course not, scoffed McKay. Do you actually think that's how it...
Shaft, this is Jumper 2, Ronan talked over him. We're ready.
Chase caught Foreman's eye.
Shaft?
Foreman mouthed at him, lifting one trademark eyebrow, just before the wall blew open. Chase actually waited a whole 15 minutes before bringing it up when they were safely settled in the jumper.
So, he said, going for casual, shaft?
Cameron kept her hands on the controls but turned her face to him, grinning widely.
Cameron, shaft, camshaft, she beamed. John suggested it.
I bet he did, McKay muttered.
What, you not like it? She asked.
Chase folded his arms.
I'm just not sure it's... you.
Ronan snickered from his seat at the back of the jumper.
He's just worried that if you're the shaft of this relationship, that makes him the vagina...
Okay, Chase said. I think that's enough about that, then.
Foreman grinned.
I think it's cute, he stated,
just to see Chase scowl. The trouble with picking locks in Atlantis was that credit cards just didn't seem to cut it when, A, there were no actual visible locks, and, B, the door was not just genetically, but apparently telepathically, attuned to the room's normal resident.
I'm not really sure about that.
Cameron resisted the urge to sigh. Lorne was shuffling his feet, one hand rubbing the back of his neck, and looking thoroughly uncomfortable.
I've gone over this with you, she said patiently. You know it's for the Colonel's own good.
Lorne's expression remained skeptic.
Kind of feels like abusing my position, not to mention disobeying direct orders.
Even Taylor and Ronan are convinced, she pointed out. The two were standing a few feet away, Taylor with her arms crossed, and Ronan looking disgruntled. But the point was that they were there.
They're going to chaperone. Make sure I don't know,
steal a pair of shepherd's boxes for my stalker chest.
Lorne shuddered. See? That's exactly the kind of imagery I'm trying to avoid. That and Colonel Shepherd's promises to gut me with a spoon if I cooperate with you. He's kind of a private guy.
Well, he's not going to be so much private as he will be dead, she said frankly, unless we get to the source of his illness, which could be lying in that room. Like I've told you before, Doctors Weir, McKay, and Zelenka have all tried to open the door themselves, but Atlantis apparently likes Shepherd too much to go against his wishes, and your emergency military override is our last hope. So, Major Lorne, are you that scared of Shepherd's retribution, or are you going to be a man and save his life?
Cameron posed with her hands on her hips, looked him straight in the eyes, and tried not to feel like her mother. She hoped her speech had struck inspiration, or at least some guilt, into his heart.
Taylor and Ronan said nothing. She decided to interpret their silence as support. At last, Lorne relented.
Fine, he said, with resignation. But if they find the alien whales playing with my gutted remains later, it'll be on your conscience.
Cameron beamed.
I've dealt with worse.
Lorne grumbled something under his breath, but stepped forward and started fiddling with the clear crystals attached to the panel beside John's door. Cameron's eyes flicked to Taylor and Ronan, finding no approval there, just that same edgy silence.
Look, we really are pros at this, she said, trying to reassure the three. Breaking and entering. It's the first rule of being a doctor.
I thought that was do no harm, Lorne said, eyes not leaving the control panel.
It's derivative.
The door opened with a whoosh, and Cameron hurried inside before she would have to spend any more time discussing the morally questionable with someone who'd be bringing up the same points she herself had argued during her first week at Princeton. John's room was nothing at all like what she'd expected. She'd known, of course, that being stationed on Atlantis wasn't exactly a short-lived post, and that city's inhabitants, especially the first ones, would consider their living quarters apartments rather than hotels. She'd guessed that John's room, him being himself, wouldn't exactly be an ideal representation of United States military barracks
ready for inspection. But where her room still had a suitcase hidden in the corner and empty shelves save for a framed photo of her family, John's had a blazing red and yellow painted surfboard leaning against the wall, a classic guitar by its side, a stack of books sitting on a low cabinet beside that. A colorful woolen blanket was tossed over the sheets, the small room was cluttered with small signs of life, and perhaps it was the soft orange lighting that draped the room from the window that made everything seem warmer than it was, but the room didn't just feel lived in, it felt like home. Lorne cleared his throat. I'm working, she said immediately, and fought the urge to snoop around for John Shepherd's secret diary, or any clue that would take her a step closer to understanding what really went on in that mysterious man's head. Her only job here was to figure out what was wrong with his body. And, one had to admit, that body was worthy of getting the very best treatment possible. But now wasn't the time for fantasies, either, Cameron resolved, waving the thought away as she scanned the contents of John's one desk drawer, which consisted of a single eraser and no pencils in sight. Okay. She continued searching the room clockwise, top to bottom, taking samples of the pinkish dust that had settled on the outer rim of John's windowsill, a bit of rust from one of his golf gloves, the last remaining drops of liquid from the bottom of an old-fashioned glass tumbler. The scientists like to experiment with brewing, Lorne explained, looking slightly embarrassed, like he was the one who'd allowed his CEO to become a guinea pig for homemade booze, and scraped dirt from the bottom of three different boots that had visited three different planets. So what, you think he got sick from stepping in cow shit? Ronan asked, a hint of challenge in his voice. Ronan and Taylor's presence had always felt reassuring when they were off-world. Now, shadowing her in John's room, they radiated hostility more than anything, and it was slightly unnerving. I honestly have no idea why he got sick, Cameron replied calmly, rummaging through another drawer. But so far, symptoms are pointing to an environmental cause, some sort of toxin, we think, that only seems to be affecting Colonel Shepherd. How is that possible? Taylor asked, frowning. It can be any number of things, from his unique physiology to whatever and wherever it is that's the source of his illness, which is why I'm here. Cameron stooped down to peek under the bed, found nothing there, and moved her eyes to a copy of War and Peace that was lying on the bedstand. Flipping through, she found a bookmark on page 199 and felt an entirely new appreciation for John, never having been able to get past page 23 herself. Can any of you think of any reason the Colonel's body would react to a toxin differently from yours? He's a natural ATA carrier, for one, that's the obvious, Lorne pointed out. Taylor appeared to give it thought. His body was once taken over by a hostile consciousness. He almost mutated into a giant bug, Ronan said flatly. Cameron stood up, surprised. Really? Ronan was giving her a cold look again. You didn't know that from his medical history? We divided it between us, she said defensively. It would have been easier if his medical file wasn't as thick as this book, she emphasized, dropping War and Peace down on the bed. Ronan grunted, and the other two didn't look any more pleased. Cameron opened John's closet, wanting to get this thing over with as soon as possible. B&E apparently involved entirely new levels of stress when overseen by a complete entourage, all of whom were fiercely overprotective of the target. The rack was so small there was only room for one suit to hang from it, a blue Air Force dress uniform, identical to her brother's, but different in rank insignia, badges, and service medals. The narrow shelves were packed with BDUs, black, blue, beige, and various camouflage patterns. Below those, some training clothes, a drawer of socks and undies she only let herself glance at, and way down on the floor, hidden underneath a sloppily folded sheet. Well, Cameron said, taking in the thin, long canisters on the left and the stocky objects stacked in a pyramid on the right. I believe my job here is done. I have to admit, it does make sense, Carson said, turning the yellow canister in his hand with curiosity. Did you run all the tests? The chemicals in the compound are similar, if not identical, to what you might find in certain kinds of pesticide on Earth, Foreman said, explaining for the benefit of others in the room. Aside from Chase and Carson, Shepherd's entire team was crowded next to his bedside. They're an exact match for the toxins we found in his blood. Carson nodded. And considering that he may still have traces of the irritus in his genome, it explains why he was both so severely affected and more susceptible than anyone else would have been. McKay glared at Shepherd, who was lying weakly on an infirmary bed, hooked up to two IVs, hair faring as well as usual.
"What the hell," he started heatedly, "made you think it was a good idea to hoard 30 cans of ancient bug spray at the bottom of your closet?"
Shepherd avoided his gaze.
McKay continued, his voice rising in tone. "Do you not consider the fact that something that killed bugs was maybe, oh, I don't know, poisonous? Or that, let alone the apparently foreign concept of an expiration date, any of these containers might have actually developed a leak within the course of 10,000 years? Or that, oh yeah, you don't touch ancient stuff without running it by me first. I mean, what was going through your head, John? What?"
Shepherd squirmed. "I don't like bugs."
Ronan raised a hand to his mouth and coughed, hiding a smile.
Ronnie raised his hands in a frustrated huff, eloquently conveying, "I just don't know what I'm going to do with him."
"Colonel," said Carson, "I agree you should have acted more responsibly with the matter. However, what's done is done, and at least we've identified the toxins."
"And with this knowledge you can heal him?" Taylor asked, looking hopeful.
Foreman sighed. "Yes. And no." The relieved expressions on Shepherd and his teammates' faces lasted only a moment. "Now that we've got the poison narrowed down to specific elements, we know what treatment to put him on. But we still don't know how exactly he's been getting contaminated all this time. And unless we know for sure, it'll probably just keep happening."
"I thought we already settled that," McKay said, ticking off his fingers. "Colonel's idiocy, bug spraying closets, poison clothes. Did I miss something?"
"It's not that simple," Chase explained. "The test results showed that the amount of toxins found on his clothes wouldn't be enough to cause such a severe reaction. Most of the poison wasn't absorbed through the skin, but inhaled through the lungs."
McKay crossed his arms.
"Well, how do you explain that, then?"
Chase and Foreman both turned to Shepherd, who shrugged meekly. They exchanged a long look, wordlessly daring each other to say the words. Finally, Chase sighed.
"Colonel, is there anything you're not telling us?"
Taylor looked shocked.
"Surely you're not suggesting that the Colonel has been lying about something?"
And for God's sake, Foreman thought, Chase did not just look up and whistle.
"We can call it omitting, if you like," Foreman said.
"Look, even Shepherd's not so dumb as to leave out details relevant to his medical treatment," McKay dismissed, then appeared to realize who he was speaking about, and turned to Shepherd with horror.
"Oh my God, you did, didn't you?"
Shepherd grimaced.
"Just how broken is your brain?"
"Easy there, Rodney," Carson said, hovering protectively next to Shepherd's head. "Don't take out his hearing, too. John?"
"Look, I didn't leave out anything, okay?" Shepherd protested, his voice still slightly hoarse from intubation.
Chase shook his head with disappointment. "Actually, we already have a hunch," he said. "We're just waiting for Dr. Cameron to come back with our latest test result."
"Got it!"
Cameron appeared in the doorway, looking pleased. She lowered her eyes to Shepherd's face affectionately.
"You could have told us, John. You shouldn't feel embarrassed about it. There's nothing wrong with being sensitive."
Shepherd's eyes widened.
"What are you talking about?"
Cameron brandished a thick orange candle in her left hand.
"Oh," he flushed. "That. I found a whole bunch of them in your closet, right next to the spray containers," Cameron explained, setting the candle down on a table and peeling off her gloves. "And they're absolutely soaked with the poison. So much, actually, that you'd only have to breathe them in for a few hours to get as sick as you did. The fact that this ancient brand of bug spray is odorless would make it impossible to detect at the time."
Ronan picked up the candle and studied it. McKay peered at it as well, and his eyes dawned with realization.
"These are the candles you lit when I was trying to ascend, aren't they? What were you doing with them now? Cooking yourself a romantic dinner? Checking the effects of candlelight on your hair?"
I lit them before going to sleep.
I..." Shepherd closed his eyes with a pained expression. "I like their scent, okay?"
Ronan turned his face away and coughed again. Taylor's lips twitched. Carson said, "It's all right, Colonel. Anyone would need to relax a bit after spending their days with Rodney. I'm just glad you'll be fine now." McKay scowled at him. Foreman spread his hands, allowing himself to feel the short-lived satisfaction of a puzzle solved, being hit for the moment by how much he missed it.
QED.
Oh, please, McKay snapped. Quit pretending that medicine can use mathematical proof like it's an actual science.
Par for the course, Foreman reminded himself, clenching a fist. Fucked up genius. Saves the world every other week.
Yeah. By the end of summer, the routine had settled into, well, nobody wanted to call it dull, because really they were in a galaxy far, far away, and none of them were arrogant enough to consider themselves overqualified to treat gunshot wounds and patch up broken bones for soldiers wounded in the line of duty, or, well, none of them were arrogant enough to voice those thoughts aloud. An encounter with the Wraith left Cameron 3 physical years older, but Chase assured her he had a thing for older women. And anyway, now she was older than Foreman and felt entitled to boss him around. Not that it actually made him listen to her, but still. Chase amused himself with small things. Puns. Atlantis, this is where. Where what? That one never grew old, even when Cameron forbade him from making jokes ever again. Squelching the occasional cockroach. I have no problems with bugs, he said smugly, and Foreman rolled his eyes. Concocting his indigenous drink, the Lupulupi, which the citizens of Atlantis actually developed a genuine taste for. When Zelenka tried to make some himself, Ronan took a sip and scrunched his nose, saying, "It's not Lupulupi." Nobody else understood why the three of them cracked up. During a visit to the infirmary to yell at one of the scientists for self-inflicted injuries, Rodney caught Foreman sneering at him from behind a patient chart. "Oh, get over yourself already," Rodney finally snapped. "Everywhere you go, there's going to be someone like us. We're here. We're startlingly more intelligent than you and general assholes, and something that rhymes with queer, and, well, sometimes that, too. Get used to it. You don't like house, you don't like me, I get it. But can you at least stop being prissy about it and let me yell at my underlings in peace?"
The only reason they didn't avoid each other after that was that they were both trying to outstubborn the other. Everybody within 100 feet of the two, though, knew to stay out of the McKay/Foreman feud.
One day, in the beginning of September, on one of those days with no patients and no missions and no end on Sudokus, Shepard had a knack for hunting them and filling them all in, and no emails to reply to, Carson was eerily prompt about that, Chase and Foreman were having a lively discussion about Greys in the mess hall.
"What is Greys?" Taylor asked, curiously, reminding them that not everyone was familiar with Earth's current, or in fact, any, pop culture references.
"It's a television show," Cameron replied. "It tells a story in episodes. It's very fascinating if you've just been fired from your job and want to feel superior over petty interns."
"No, no, it's got brilliant romance," Chase leant forward. "See, there's this doctor, right? Meredith, and this guy, Shepard, and everyone's basically waiting for them to get together already. Although, if you ask me, I don't know why, because Shepard's all messed up, you know, with his ex-wife and his weird fixation with Ferris wheels."
At which point Rodney choked 2 tables over. Taylor smiled wildly, and half the cafeteria stared.
"Ferry boats," Foreman corrected mildly.
"Right," Chase said, distracted. "Those," and proceeded to animatedly explain the rest of the plot to Taylor. John clapped Rodney on the back until he settled down.
"Yeah, I'm pretty sure that one wasn't on when he left Earth in 2004.
Which went to show that life on Atlantis was immensely exciting. Except for when it wasn't. In the end, space was nice and all, but, well, McKay was still an ass, and they'd just discovered how the 3 positions on Carson's team had become available in the first place. Disturbing information, to say the least. And there was that thing on PCX-113, which they vowed never to speak of again. And the new Harry Potter had come out on Earth over a month ago, and Chase still had some money riding on whether Snape was evil, after all. And maybe, maybe, they kind of missed home a little. Their goodbyes were swift, or droll, or heartfelt. As a gesture of goodwill, Foreman left the Atlanteans with James Wilson's business card and a word of advice. "Just try to stay away from nukes. And if you get back to Earth when you get cancer, call this guy. He's the best." Rodney frowned.
"Don't you mean when we get back to Earth? If we get cancer?"
"No."
"Let it go, McKay," John murmured with a gently restraining hand on his arm.
and smiled easily at the three doctors. We appreciate it. Have a safe trip back.
Cheers, Carson waved, smiling warmly, and for the last time they took in Atlantis, this great city with its crystal towers and sparkling waters and hard-working people, which was certainly home. It just wasn't theirs. When the Daedalus beamed them up, they were ready to return.
Epilogue. House didn't actually care what his fellows had been doing over the summer. Being able to exchange new guys' incompetence for the more familiar incompetence of his old fellows was enough for him. And even if he was mildly curious, he wasn't about to do anything ridiculous like ask them to share. However, a few days after they'd returned to work, whatever buzz they'd been riding over the summer faded away, and suddenly the kids wouldn't meet each other's eyes, refused to talk to Wilson about it, and it was getting on his nerves. There was an uncomfortable silence in the office, not the frosty "you stole my article" kind, but the awkward morning after kind. And once the suspicions were raised in his head, House made a phone call to Washington.
"Jack," he said pleasantly, "is there any reason my newly rehired minions are acting like aliens made them do it?"
The silence stretched for 5 beats.
"Sorry," O'Neill said, almost cheerfully, not asking who House was talking about. "Classified information."
"Right," House said with delight. "Kinky."
"I have no idea what you're talking about."
"Of course, as you were."
"Doing paperwork," O'Neill paused.
"Yay. Goodbye, House," he sighed.
House hung up, smirking.
Fin.
There are author's notes, which I'm going to read to you now. First, the notes coming before the story, which say that it is set after the House season 3 finale and sometimes after the Tower of Rodney, with thanks mostly to Queen Zulu for encouraging me, that is to say, Rhoda, to write, even as I wallowed in procrastination. And second, the notes after the story, which read, "The 'you guys know we can hear you, right?' joke was taken from Sports Night, and I'm not sure if the idea of poison candles came from my mind or one of Pratchett's Discworld novels, but I suspect it was the latter. The check spoken here was what I could dig up from online research and translates to, 'Your check? No, my father, I don't speak much check. But feel free to correct me if you spot mistake.' For those of you wondering why John was so embarrassed at liking scented candles, the real reason is that they create ambience whenever he's posing for Lorne, and Lorne's words is not that good a painter, really. It's the candlelight working miracles. Thanks for reading, and thanks for listening."